Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sue Fraser, representing my colleagues on the Press Club Committee. Would you please make welcome the President of the South Australian Press Club, Don Riddell.
Thank you, Sue, and welcome back. Welcome to a lot of new faces to the Press Club. And so all I have to tell you is what goes on. Our guest speaker starts talking to us about 1 o'clock. I'll introduce him then. In the meantime, please partake of what I hope is a delicious meal. The speaker will talk for about half an hour or 40 minutes or so, and then the time till 2 o'clock will be taken up with questions from the media. And if the media runs dry, from questions from anyone else. So, I look forward to seeing you later on. Thank you. Back to Sue.
Thank you, Don. On behalf of the committee, I wish to acknowledge Telstra as a corporate supporter of the Press Club and to thank their representatives for their ongoing support. Also, our thanks to Qantas for assistance with airfares for our guests when they're required. SA Brewing has provided for your enjoyment Hahn Premium and Hahn Premium Light. Our wine sponsor is Orlando Wyndham, and today we're serving Jacobs Creek Reserve Chardonnay 2000 and Jacobs Creek Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon 1998, so please enjoy. And if you're not on our mailing list for future functions, we'd like you to be, so please give us your business card or leave your name at the front desk with Alison before you leave. And now to the raffle. We have some goodies for you today. Tickets are $2 each or three for $5. Let me tell you what we have. A Telstra Panasonic cordless phone, I'm sure you'd like that. 2 tickets to the hit musical Shout at the Festival Theatre, starring David Campbell and the music of Johnny O'Keefe. 12 bottles of Jacobs Creek wines from Orlando Wyndham, 6 red, 6 white. A two-bottle pack of a new wine, proudly produced by our committee member Robert Main. Its name is Bimbimbi, and it's 1999 Bimbimbi McLaren Vale Shiraz, and Robert tells me that Bimbimbi means meeting place of the birds. It's the name of his property near McLaren Vale. Was that a big enough plug, Robert? And what does it sell for? About $10.17 a bottle, cheap at half the price. We have a CD of the music from Shout, The Legend of the Wild One, a carton of Hahn Premium Beer from SA Brewing, The Light, and I think we have also the Hahn Premium, so we have 2 cartons there. We have 3 double VIP passes to the Royal Adelaide Show, thanks to Francine Connor. Now, the show, there's only 78 days to go, believe it or not. Starts on 31st of August to the 8th of September. And from Walter Rogers, we have the $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouges Street, where you can take yourself for some wonderful food, seafood. And a $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street for some legendary fine Italian food. So buy up those tickets, $2 each, 3 for $5. Back soon. Thank you. Enjoy your lunch.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's 1 o'clock. It's 1 o'clock. I don't think there's any subject in South Australia that people are angry about than the price and supply of electricity. And despite the good works of our media colleagues, I don't think there's any subject we know less about. All we know is that they got it wrong. We don't actually know who they are or what they did or didn't do. Today we're going to find out. Our guest, Dr. Robert Booth, is one of Australia's top experts on the production and distribution of electricity. His credentials went on for pages, starting, as he just told me, as an apprentice, and then on and on and on, more and more degrees. He's an advisor in several states. He's a member of the World Energy Council. He's going to chair a meeting here next week. He's a fellow of all the relevant institutions. The one that got me is that he wrote a book called Warring Tribes, The Story of Power Development in Australia. So what's the war about and who's winning? Dr. Robert Booth.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I must say it's a very real pleasure for me to be here today to respond to the invitation from the Press Club to speak to you. It's obvious that I'm in Adelaide and the priorities are still correct because I noticed that the wines were introduced before the guest speaker. Now, I'm sure, as the Chairman has said, that none of you will be unaware of the intense interest that there is in what was, until a few years ago, a very moribund industry. and one always takes for granted that the lights are always going to be on and that electric power is going to be freely available. That old moribund industry has all of a sudden got interesting again. But I have no doubt that if I wind the clock back for 12 months, I would not have been invited to such an august gathering. Indeed, you probably would have invited the Treasurer, who would have been telling you how clever he was that he'd raised over $5 billion by selling off or leasing off the various parts of the previous EPSA organisation. And that would have been the topic of a speech. This time last year, I'm sure I would have been ridiculed had I stood here and predicted that prices for some 40% of the customers in South Australia were about to go up by increases of the order of 30 and as high as 90%, and not only that, they'd be locked into them for 5 years. This time last year, I'm sure that I would have been ridiculed had I told you that California was about to experience a tenfold increase in their wholesale prices, and the once great utilities that supply San Francisco and Los Angeles would be bankrupt within 7 months. This time last year, and out of a sense of considerable frustration, I wrote this book that the chairman referred to, which, as he said, I called Warring Tribes, and I took as my theme that very cutting statement, and you can see how despondent I was at the time, that Australia is not so much a nation, but more a series of warring tribes. And the book documented my involvement in the industry, but more particularly how, from the coming of electricity in Australia, the states really have failed to get their act together. And I'll point out in a moment that it's mainly the states that bears the blame for this, and that Australia really is lagging behind the rest of the world in developing a modern and secure electricity supply system. I thought last year that I'd been cursed with the curse of Cassandra, that I was cursed to tell the truth, but also cursed that no one would believe me. And I think I was about the only person in Australia this time last year who was prepared to stand up and be counted. Everyone else seemed to have run for cover. Now, 12 months on, I feel that I'm like the little boy in the Hans Christian Andersen story of the Emperor's New Clothes. And part of my job is to tell you that the national electricity market emperor, if I can use that term, indeed has no clothes. And it's about time that our leaders faced up to that fact and did something about it. As the chairman said, I can hardly get away with calling myself a little boy, however. I had one of those terrible birthdays with a zero on the end in February, and it marked 45 years of involvement in the electricity and gas industries in Australia on both the government and the private sector side. So I think that I'm rather well qualified to be able to give you my views on the matter. But I must say, even I have been surprised at the speed and the severity of the crisis which engulfed, first of all, the United Kingdom until the regulator stepped in, that engulfed California, beginning about this time, early in June of last year. And I must also confess that I've been a little bit surprised at the speed with which the problems that I predicted have emerged in Australia. I trust we are not heading for the same kind of dreadful situation that California finds itself in, but I fear that there are more things that are similar in what we have done than there are that are different to California. And for that reason, I believe that we very clearly need to be careful. So I'm honoured with you today, and what I'm going to try and do is to tell you a little bit about how we got into the situation, where the major problems are, and what has to be done to correct the situation. But I'm pleased that today marks a bit of a change in the speeches that I've been given, in the sense that I believe now I don't have to convince people that we have a problem, and surely I don't have to convince people that it's to do with lack of competition and lack of interconnections and lack of political will. So I hope that most of the emphasis in the speech will be at the back end, where I can start to talk about what we've got to do to fix the problem. And I hope that it leads to a better understanding on the part of all of you of what, as I say, has been quite a closed industry. In my book, I point out the fact that we're troubled by the Australian Constitution. It leaves the primary responsibility for electricity and gas supply with the states. There's virtually no role set out in the Constitution for the Commonwealth. If there is a role, it's only just where interstate trade is involved, and that's been a power that the Commonwealth has been curiously reluctant to test over the years. And I don't think I need to tell you that over the years the states have jealously guarded this constitutional right. They take an intensely parochial attitude towards their rights to look after electricity and gas and other matters as well, And this has resulted in Australia having one of the least interconnected electricity systems of any comparable country in the world. And I might add, we have some long distances to deal with, but so does Canada, so does Sweden, so does Russia. We're not alone in that respect. There is an Adelaide link in my book. Back in 1926, Sir John Monash, the eminent First World War general, came to Adelaide to be inducted as the president of the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science. Monash, you know about, he was renowned as a great communicator. He gave a speech which he called Power Development, and he preached this message of how noble was the task of bringing power development to Australia. And he not only that, he set out the recipe for how you develop an electricity supply system of the widest possible implication. He spoke of the schemes that were afoot in America in 1926, as he said, to link up the powerhouses on the Atlantic coast with those on the Pacific coast. And he also envisaged what he called a super system for Australia. And he stated in the presidential address of the amalgamation of power supply undertakings for the express purpose of achieving the electrical linking up of powerhouses and also a rigid standardisation of voltage, phase and frequency so as to permit a free interchange of electrical energy between the several systems. He said, in this way alone can we achieve the desideratum that an electricity supply super system covering large territories and serving a large population may attain the highest practical economies of operation. Now, I doubt in the press coverage that may follow this talk the word desideratum will appear. It's very much a 1926 one. But you can see that Australia started off with some very excellent advice and they were told how to do it. But did the states take that advice? No. They chose to ignore it and proceeded to develop their electricity systems largely in isolation. They chose different transmission voltages. For many years we even had different frequencies, which is an absolute no-no in electricity supply. And the different transmission voltages in the states, really the electrical equivalent of the railway gauge problem that we all talk about in terms of inhibiting Australia's development. None of the interconnections that count in Australia can take place without an annoying interposing transformer station, which in electrical terms effectively moves the states further apart. Now, in my book, I document the fact that there were two major opportunities to do something about this in Australia's history. One was when the Snowy Mountains scheme was developed, when Victoria scuppered a very well-developed and sensible scheme that would have unified New South Wales, Snowy and Victoria. Being in South Australia, I've got to tell you, South Australia wasn't uppermost in their minds when they were putting the Snowy scheme together. And another one was when the Zeidler Committee at the end of the 1970s, some of you remember the 1970s, I do, Australia was to have a mineral boom. We were going to have aluminium smelters in every state, and the Prime Minister wrote to the premiers to say, get your infrastructure up to speed. New South Wales proceeded to put in 10 660 megawatt units, I might add. But the Zeidler Committee was set up to look to see whether there was a case for strong interconnections between the states. And they failed to find one, except for what they described as a modest interconnection between Victoria and South Australia. And this is the one that finally happened about 10 years later. And I might add, brought very great benefits to South Australia for many years, and in fact still does. But the trouble is the Zeidler Committee made their decision on cost estimates provided by the states, and within 2 years those cost estimates were shown to be quite wrong. Cost of power out of brown coal stations in Victoria was almost double the estimates of those provided to the Zeidler Committee. But the committee was never reconvened and its work was never done, and so another opportunity was missed. And it was finally when Victoria decided to build yet another brown coal power station in the Latrobe Valley, I used to refer to them as building a cathedral, that they were being built for religious reasons, not for economic reasons, and went ahead at a time when there was clearly cheaper and abundant power available in New South Wales, which had been offered to them at an attractive price. And for the first time in the history of Australia, apart from the Snowy scheme, this precipitated some intervention by the federal government. And in the late 1980s, they moved in and started to initiate inquiries, led in particular by Paul Keating, who, as you probably will remember, was no lover of the states. And there was an unusual and rare period of cooperation between states and federal government at the end of the 80s. It was associated with some political imperatives facing Bob Hawke as Prime Minister, meaning that he wanted to be re-elected, and keep his job, Paul Keating was treasurer, and he wanted to be prime minister and wanted to get to the States, and Nick Briner was premier of New South Wales, and he had all of these spare power plants that he wanted to do something with. And there was an attempt to seek, I think, I shouldn't be too flippant, because I think there was a genuine period when they were trying to get a better basis for federalism in Australia, as Bob Hawke used to say, to set Australia up for the second century of federation. And it led to the series of special premiers' conferences, which were the forerunners of what we now call the COAG meetings. And I see, I'm just back from Europe, I see one of them took place on Friday and made some decisions on electricity, which I'll refer to a little later. The first of these special premiers' conferences had electricity as number one item. And the premiers in the States got together to say it's time we had a national grid. And they set four objectives for that national grid. One was that they were going to have stronger interconnections. They even spoke of advanced clearance of easements to facilitate these stronger interconnections that were going to be built. They said we're going to select new power plants on a competitive, multi-state basis. No longer would one state arbitrarily decide to build, as I say, a cathedral in the Latrobe Valley. They were going to provide grid access to everybody, and they were going to allow customers to enter into direct contracts with generators and have freedom of choice of their supplier. Now, the first of those premiers' conferences was almost exactly 10 years ago, about this time of the year. It was a little later in the year, 1991. If you judge our progress on those objectives, we get one mark out of four. The only one of those objectives that we have achieved is that everybody has access to the grids these days. We do not have stronger interconnections, we do not select power plants on a competitive multi-state basis, and we do not allow customers to go directly to generators to get contracts, real contracts, not financial contracts. And all that we have is an incredible obsession against with a system that is short-term in orientation, the price today, tomorrow, next week, when electricity is a long-term thing, not a short-term thing. Now, what happened in the 90s is that after these noble resolutions, the warring tribes took over again. The process became intensely political. It was governmental. It was very secretive. It, frankly, ran off the rails. Attempts by the Commonwealth government to establish a national electricity strategy, to form a single national grid corporation, and even, would you believe, offers of $100 million that were made to the states of Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia to build stronger interconnections, and another to buy the states out of the Snowy scheme, were ignored by what I call in my book the Warring Tribes. It was not a pretty process to watch. It was like the joke that was made when the European Community was being formed, when it was said that they were looking for a combination of German efficiency, French cooking, Italian lifestyle and British culture. And instead what they got was French lifestyle, German culture, Italian efficiency and British cooking. But I'm afraid it was a little more sinister than that, and that was the change of heart that took place in Victoria in 1994. After their election in 1992, the Kennett government set out to implement an energy policy of which I was one of the authors, I must confess. They stayed true to the general principles and for the first 12 months did a very good job. They implemented a very sensible series of structural change. They introduced competition, disaggregated the old SECV, the organisation that I had grown up in. I was happy to be quite intensively involved in this early stage. It's interesting, and I want you to remember, that it was during this period that there were dramatic improvements in the performance of the electricity industry in that state and elsewhere, which most people quite incorrectly ascribed to privatisation. It was not. It occurred while the industry was in government ownership. And indeed, even now, some of the once moribund government organisations in New South Wales and Queensland perform like champions because of the introduction of competition. So I'm a very firm believer in competition. So don't get me wrong when I criticise the national market later on, of which a change of ownership may play a part, and certainly the introduction of new ideas needs to play a part. And I think that's the most important lesson that we can learn out of what's happened over the last 10 years. Competition is good if it's implemented, but what we must do is to have systems that allow the benefits of competition to flow through to end customers. But by 1994, the imperative in Victoria all of a sudden changed. An Englishman turned up, He said, I was there when Maggie Thatcher privatised the whole of the industry. They raised a lot of money. Why are you worried about the debt that sits with the SECV? If you give me my head, I'll package up and sell the whole lot, just like Maggie Thatcher did. And lo and behold, I'll be able to give you back the state's AAA credit rating. And incredibly, within about 3 months, the government completely changed their view. And from there on, I'm afraid greed took over. And the objectives that were in the energy policy about making Victoria competitive again and empowering customers were forgotten in the rush for money. And one of the consequences of that was Victoria copied what Maggie Thatcher had done in the UK, including this very unusual, rather silly way of compelling all the electricity to be sold into a common pool and having the price of electricity in that pool set by open bids by generators, and somebody loads them all up until there's enough of them being loaded to meet the demand, and whatever the price is at the time in which the demand is met, everybody gets paid. Irrespective of what they offered to be paid, they get paid the same price. If you like, and technically all the generators get this single market price, and they are prohibited from selling directly to customers. AGL or retailers must buy from the same compulsory pool. Now, I'll tell you that it always was a crazy system, and I'll give you a hint about what I'm going to say, that it was only ever copied three times, one in Alberta, and it fell over after a couple of years and was fairly inconsequential, one in Australia and one in California. And it's now been abandoned in the UK. It brought California to the brink of bankruptcy, and we remain the one place in the world that continues to try and run one of these crazy trading systems. You don't have to take my word from it. When I came back on Friday, I caught up with some of the papers, and the body that is called NECA, centred here in Adelaide, that is meant to administer the market, opened a report by saying, the market rules currently allow generators effectively unfettered discretion to rebid their available capacity and the price at which they offer that capacity in the market right up to the point of dispatch. And the price that they can offer typically can run anything from $10 a megawatt hour. For those of you who are as old as me, that's 1 cent a kilowatt hour. Divide these figures by 10 to get them into cents a kilowatt hour. But they can bid anything from $10 a megawatt hour up to $5,000 a megawatt hour, a range of 500. And unless somebody does something really quickly, by next April, they're going to be able to bid up to $10,000 a megawatt hour, a very foolish decision if ever there was one. In my view, this is verging on the ridiculous. I can tell you that the cost of producing electricity simply does not and cannot vary by anywhere near these amounts. Most of the cost of production are, in fact, fixed and quite stable. And even the variation in fuel costs from the cheapest plant to the highest cost plant, for example, here in South Australia, is relatively moderate compared to that range. This UK-style trading system was designed by generators for the benefit of generators, not for the benefit of customers. And it is an open invitation for generators to exploit the rules and to generate very volatile and high prices. And it relies on the fact that there is supposed to be intense competition between the generators to keep the price under control. And I might ask you rhetorically now and answer it myself later, how can you get intense competition when there are only three generators operating in South Australia? Now, my willingness to assist the Victorian government stopped very quickly at that time, and I stood up in public and criticised them. I say in the book that made me about as popular as a pork chop in a synagogue. Once Victoria had gone that way, however, it had a destructive effect on the national market, because they turned up at the forums and said, well, if we're going to have a national market, you must do it our way, and no other way is going to be allowed. And so the national market effectively was forced to go the same way as Victoria had gone by the unilateral actions. Now, 12 months ago, I had to try and convince people that there were problems. I don't know that I have to these days. I can recount to you simply what happened. In the states of Victoria and New South Wales, when they opened up these competitive markets, prices fell. And if you were lucky enough to be a big industry and competitive at that time, there were wonderful deals around. You could buy wholesale power delivered to your premises in the low $20 a megawatt hour. I'll tell you in a moment that the prevailing cost over the counter in South Australia next year is $70 a megawatt hour. But you could buy wholesale power at 20. And there were industries that hopped in and got wonderful price reductions. And I'm afraid the politicians are still dining out on that what will be seen in the course of history to be a very unusual, very narrow and very short period of time that applied, as I say, only to Victoria and New South Wales. In Queensland and South Australia, wholesale prices immediately went up and have stayed up and have kept going up in South Australia. In Queensland, they've had a rush of new investment because the prices were so high, and the prices are now starting to moderate. But in South Australia, the wholesale price, and I'll put that into context in a moment, is about twice what it was before we began these competitive markets. The government and its advisers a couple of years ago carried out innumerable studies and were quite convinced that the wholesale price was not going to go above $40 a megawatt hour in South Australia, and in fact by now should have been falling down to a figure like 36. People like me didn't believe them. We argued, and in the end the ACCC thankfully put a ceiling of $40, and that's the reason why domestic tariffs in South Australia up to now have not increased. They're capped at a wholesale price of $40. In the meantime, as I say, the prevailing price for next year has gone as high as $70. To get this into perspective, the average retail price paid in South Australia last year was $101 a megawatt hour. In old-style terms, that's 10.1 cents a kilowatt hour. So the wholesale price was making up about 40% of the total price. But, of course, you can see easily how when the wholesale price goes from 40 to 70, the retail price goes from 100 to 130, and very quickly you're talking about 30, 40 and even more percentage increases in price. And it's a good thing that we persuaded the ACCC to set that cap, because at least the domestic customers, but I'm afraid some of you here will be in the industrial and commercial side, poor old industry and commerce is actually getting it in the neck. They've had to put up with price rises, as you've seen, of 30 to as high as 90%, although I understand that if you're part of the government, you only pay 13.6%. Now, I can tell you that these prices are far too high to be acceptable. They are well above the prices that are needed to justify new investment. In fact, they're almost twice the price that is needed to justify new investment. They are well above the prices that you would ever expect to get had we had even a moderately competitive market. They are just simply unacceptable. And I ask you, do we have to cripple South Australia's economic future in order to encourage investment in power generation facilities and to line the pockets of a small number of selected overseas and Australian investors? I must say that I tell you, I think we do not. I think we need to inject a dose of reality and common sense here. In fact, what's happened in this national market is the average price of electricity, after initially falling, has gone back up above the level that prevailed before we began the changes. And it seems to me that that ought to be the sign to ring alarm bells in all the political capitals or all the national capitals around the country. And yet until recently it's been very hard to get people to actually sit up and take notice. I don't have to tell you that the impact of these significant price increases on industry and commerce in South Australia are going to be severe. And I'll let other people who are the victims of this outcome to tell you what it's going to do to their business. Not in all of the history of the old, much maligned, government-controlled industry did we ever see price rises of that magnitude and that duration. And that ought to make you stop and think also to say that I'm afraid this national electricity market emperor has no clothes. And even in Victoria now, they're just starting to see the impact of the prices flowing through. I noticed while I was away, the retailers there are asking for a 15% increase. Now, this is not what the man in the street expected the national electricity market to deliver. There will be a public backlash, and you are seeing it here in South Australia at the present time. If the government were to be game to allow the domestic consumers to get the benefit of this competitive market, as they're supposed to do at the end of next year, you can imagine the uproar that will result. Now, I think, being realistic, there is no way that the government will ever allow the domestic consumers to have the benefit of this new competitive market when it's clear the prices will go up. They will only be allowed to come onto the market when they're sure the prices will go down. So for those of you who are betting your future on full retail contestability, as the term is used, I wouldn't hold your breath. I think there'll either be deliberate actions to delay it, or there'll be terrible troubles with metering systems or computer systems, but no state government, in my view, is going to allow domestic customers to see significant price increases. And the other thing about electricity prices is that they are extraordinarily volatile. They go up and down over this incredible range from, they were as low as $10 in the early hours of the morning last week, I noticed. They go as high as $5,000 a megawatt hour. Next year they'll be able to go as high as $10,000. I'm afraid that volatility in electricity price in what I would like to start calling this dysfunctional market is due to the exploitation of the loose rules of the market. It is not due to naturally occurring economic factors. And here I must protect myself by saying while I accuse the generators of exploiting the market, I must say that they have an absolutely perfect defence, and that is that they are legally allowed to do what they do. The rules of the market were authorised by the ACCC, and they are immune from legal action. And I must say also that were I on the board of one of the generators, I probably would have a duty to my shareholders to test those rules that have been set by government to the extreme to maximise the profits to my shareholders. My argument is with the rules and with the governments. It's not with the actions of the generators. Now, a couple of other things. One thing that we expected to get was at least the same reliability out of this national market that we used to get, and I'm afraid it's failed on that score as well. The one publication that came out showed that the national market was experiencing a rate of loss of supply of almost 10 times their own standard. There's another report due out soon, but I don't expect to see much of an improvement in that. We have had difficulty in getting new investment. You know, there's a flood of people wanting to put power plants in now, but I'm afraid it's a couple of years too late. If you start to build a new power plant now, unless you can get hold of some second-hand, inefficient, probably inappropriate plant from places like New Zealand or New South Wales, then it's going to take you 3 years to get a plant up. And I do not see the logic of having high prices persisting for at least 3 years before you get new generation. The market doesn't have the right set of rules to encourage not only new generation, but the right kind of generation. And then perhaps one of the most persistent failings is that it's failed to give us these strong interconnectors that we were promised. There is only one significant interconnector that's gone ahead in the last 10 years. That's between Queensland and New South Wales. And thankfully, it was approved by the independent actions of the two governments before the national market rules came into effect. And had they been had that interconnector be subject to those rules, I believe we'd still be waiting for it. And the two interconnections that really count, the one between New South Wales and Victoria, well, just about 2 months ago, belatedly, the Victorian government had a look at the economics of strengthening that, found an overwhelming case in favour of strengthening it. And the one that really counts for you people, the interconnection between New South Wales and South Australia, has been rejected once when the government did a disgraceful about turn. After having supported it, they then rejected it because it would have taken away the value of the generators. It failed once, and it's now tied up in an evaluation process that is so bureaucratic and contorted and wrong that you would not believe it. I don't expect to see that interconnection for at least 3 years unless the government's mount a crash program to cut through the red tape that binds it up. There are a couple of entrepreneurial interconnections going. One is coming from Berry across to from Redcliffs in New South Wales across to Berry. Unfortunately, it's not going to be there for next summer. And it only makes money if it perpetuates the difference in prices between South Australia and Victoria, I'm afraid. And even though I like the technology, I'm afraid I don't like the idea. Interconnectors ought to eliminate differences in prices between regions, not perpetuate them. And I think if I look back on what we missed out on over the last 10 years, what went wrong in England, what went wrong in California, it's because we or the governments, I must say that I've been speaking this way for many years, but the government's missed out on this thing that the economists call market power. It's a market where you're allowed complete freedom to do what you like, but one or two players are able to set the price at whatever level they like. They have so much power in the market that nobody can stop them. You can't store electricity, and there are times when Torrens Island has to run to support the voltage in Adelaide, or Newport has to run in Victoria to support the voltage around Melbourne. There are times in electricity when one or two players are going to be able to set the price if you give them the freedom to do so, irrespective of whether they're under competitive pressure or not. We forgot about market power, and that's the cause of our problems. It's what is the net cause of California's problems. I must add that it's easy to exercise market power if you have a very tight supply and demand situation. So one way that people exercise it is just simply to withhold capacity. In fact, I must tell you, apart from my book, which has turned out to be quite a best-selling thing, the paper that I have that is most read that I have produced recently is actually called, rather cheekily, How to Succeed in the Electricity Business Without Really Generating. And I disclosed what was happening last summer, how Loyang in Victoria was withholding as much as 1,000 megawatts, I mean that's a third of South Australia's peak demand, on any one day, in order to load up the interconnection from New South Wales so New South Wales couldn't compete, and that 1,000 megawatt would magically reappear from a price that was about $13 a megawatt hour, and lo and behold, it would be re-offered at $4,500 in a situation where the market operator had to call on it. And so they were manipulating the market, I keep saying, quite legally and quite within the rules, and I've had lots of discussions with the Loyang guys about this. They know what I say. My fight is with the rules and not with the generators, but if you're interested in how they get away with it, then have a look at that How to Succeed in Electricity Business Without Really Generating. You can download it from the Bardak, bardak.com.au website. This business of capacity withholding and strategic bidding emerged in the UK within a couple of years. It emerged in California after 2 or 3 years. It has emerged here with great vengeance after two or three years. And I'm afraid that those people that are supposed to monitor the market here don't take it seriously. This organisation called NECA appears to be quite happy to accept the most specious of reasons, including generators saying, oh, we rebid 500 megawatts from $13 a megawatt hour to $4,500 just at 5 minutes' notice yesterday, for profit maximisation purposes. And NECA gives them a tick and says, that's very good, that's a fine excuse. But they make no criticism about the practice or the rules under which they are allowed to do that. I think we must step in and impose quite severe limitation on the ability of the generators to make use of the market power that they hold. And the present code is very silent on this issue. Or we must change the trading system. And I'm afraid I'm going to tell you in a moment that we're going to have to do both. So the deep intake of breath around the room is from the representatives of the generators that are here. Now, a lot of people don't know that in the system that we have effectively copied in the United Kingdom, it started to run away after 4 years in 1994. And they had a strong and a vigilant regulator there. We don't have one of those. And he stepped in. All of a sudden, within a space of about 3 months, the price of electricity in the UK went up by a factor of four, from something like £20 per megawatt hour, all of a sudden it was sitting at 80. And the regulator stepped in and he said, bad boys, I'm going to report you to the Monopolies and Merger Commission and take away your toy, the pool. And instead, he ended up doing a deal with the generators, which was very delicately expressed in that the generators agreed to modify their bidding behaviour so as to achieve an annual average price over a financial year of £24.60. And would you believe, after having gone to £80 per megawatt hour, the price suddenly dived and stayed around £15 per megawatt hour, so that at the end of the financial year it was exactly £24.60. And from there on it was £24.60 escalated by the retail price increase in the UK, and never would it ever come down. And so that same regulator, after having had to cap the price after 4 years of operation, after 8 years, was so frustrated that he recommended to government that the pool had to go. And so the UK started to throw it out in 1998, and the new system, which they strangely call NETA, the New Electricity Trading Arrangements, began operation on the 27th of March last year. I went and had a look at how it was going last week. I'm happy to report that the average price in the month of May was £17.80. All of a sudden, they've achieved the reduction in price down to sensible level that the old pool was never able to do. And just in case you've missed my message, it was done because they had a strong and vigilant regulator. And I have in my notes here a statement that says, and a strong and vigilant regulator with the power to step in quickly is not in evidence in the Australian national market structure. And as I mentioned before, it took just a frighteningly short 7 months to bring the Californian industry to its knees, and they have two or three years of absolute horror ahead of those as they try now and take the actions to get themselves out of this mess that they've got themselves in. The compulsory pool that I am so against actually went bankrupt at the end of January in California and is never to be seen again, thank goodness. So the English one is gone, Californian one is gone, the only one that is left is ours. And my concern is that it doesn't take very long for one of these markets to run out of control. Now, a little comment about regulator. We have far too many regulators in Australia on electricity and gas. We have one or two in every state. We have a couple at the federal level, but as I've said, I don't believe that they are at all effective. It's a recipe for duplication, for the spreading of scarce resources, for inconsistent approaches, for passing the buck with nobody actually bearing the responsibility for the outcome. We're seeing all of these effects. At the risk of becoming biblical, it occurred to me the biblical phrase, and they all with one accord began to make excuses. And I think that's what we're getting now. As the French kid says, ce n'est pas faux, it's not my fault. They're all saying, it's not my fault. And say triple C's, or it's NECA's, or it's the state regulators, not mine. They all with one accord are beginning to make excuses. And on the one hand, we regulate our network owners down to the last nut and bolt. Kim Tothill and his staff are here from Electranet. I bet they had to get approval from Lou Owens to attend this dinner. And on the other hand, we give the generators complete freedom to bid anything from $10 a megawatt hour to $5,000. I mean, we are way out of balance in our approach to regulation. We must move in, I'm afraid, for the generators and implement what overseas they call market monitoring and market power mitigation measures, if you like, put them under regulatory control. But on the other hand, I'd like to see us find a way in which we ease the regulatory burden on Kim and the other network owners in Australia. And we've created two new national companies. They are called NECA and NEMCO. I'm tempted to use my normal term. I call them Tweedledum and Tweedledee. They are out of control. They are unregulated. They are owned entirely by my warring tribes. Only the warring tribes own shares in them. Only the warring tribes appoint directors. They obviously do the bidding of the warring tribes. I think we've created two empires that are out of control, and I have severe doubts about the competence of both of them. I don't hide my light under the bushel. I would get rid of NECA tomorrow, and I would severely curtail the power of NEMCO. Now, a comment about South Australia, and then what can we do about all of this? South Australia, interestingly enough, was the most reluctant of the participants in the national market. They qualified their report year after year in the early parts of the 1990s. They, after all, had a 20-year contract with Victoria that was delivering about a third of the state's energy at very low cost. The state also opposed the use of this market that I am so offended by, and indeed supported a market that is like the new UK one and the way that I would like to see things happen. South Australia supported the interconnection, Riverlink. It was done jointly by South Australia and New South Wales. But in recent years, I'm afraid the government's taken a series of actions that really have aggravated the problems with the national market as it has affected South Australia. They changed their mind over Riverlink because, as I say, they were told that it was going to take away the value of the generation assets. They restructured the industry with scant regard to competition. There are only three significant generators, now a couple of smaller guys coming in, NRG Flinders now, TXU Torrens and Australian National Power, just three in a market, as I say, that depends on competition to work. They put the contract for the Osborne cogeneration plant in with Flinders, missed the opportunity to create another independent source. They sold Synergen to National Power, missed a chance again to have an additional competitor. And what in fact happens in South Australia is that the price of electricity on any day is really what the owners of TXU and Torrens wants it to be. Because most of the time they're the only plant that is sitting on the margin. Whatever their bid is, it has to be accepted, and that's the price. And I'm afraid, I'm worried by the fact that while I welcome the proposals for new plant, I'm worried by the fact that most of them are coming from those same players. So South Australia is not actually diversifying its ownership of generation. And then on the retail side, they formed just one retailer. And unfortunately, one of the characteristics of our mishandling of generation is no other retailer can afford to contract from power out of the state and bring it over this interconnector because the risk is simply too great. And in the end, the one retailer was necessarily given access to the generating capacity in the state, and that's given them a virtual monopoly. And until we do something about interconnectors, other retailers are going to find it very difficult to get into the state. So the combination has left South Australia with clearly inadequate competition in generation, inadequate interconnection capacity with the other states, a lack of incentive unless prices are incredibly high and unacceptably high, virtually no retail competition, and I'm afraid because they've leased it all, a virtual complete lack of control over wholesale price levels and their effect on retail prices. So South Australia has the highest average tariff now of all of the eastern states. It has been beaten in the past by Western Australia with their high fuel costs and greater distances, but I'm afraid with the price rises that are now flowing through, I'm not at all confident that South Australia won't win the Guernsey as being the highest price state in Australia within the next 12 months. Now, what should we do about it? I'm going to leave you with three suggestions and I'm going to finish my talk. In my book, I had them as 10. In fact, I was tempted to call the chapter of the book Ten Commandments, but I thought that might have been a bit pretentious. But I find the politicians can't count up to 10, so I've decided to reduce it to 3. And I believe that what we've now got to do is to face up to the somewhat unpalatable fact that we're going to have to reform the trading system, we're going to have to reform our handling of transmission networks, and we're going to have to reform our regulatory system. And under the first heading, it seems to me that we're going to have to face up to the fact this compulsory pool that we've got is going to have to go. Just like it's gone in California and gone in London, it must go here. I think because the prices are running out of control, we're going to have to impose temporary limitations on the bidding practices of the generators and maybe even impose a temporary wholesale price cap. As I say, that didn't take a breath was the generators again, until such time as we can get prices under control and back to reasonable levels. Operating with direct contracts between generators and customers at freely negotiated prices. These days the internet helps us because people buy and sell blocks of power like we buy and sell shares. And then the only central thing that you've got to do is to have a last minute or last hour balancing market to just buy and sell a little bit around the edge to get the balance exactly right. In the transmission arrangements, the second of my 3 points, you can remember 3, I'm sure, I think we're going to have to make the transmission companies responsible for the cost of congestion. That intake of breath was from Kim Totter and his people, because I think that's the only way that they will see the incentive to actually build the interconnectors or contract with generators to get constraints and their costs out of the system. We clearly have to mount a program to build the stronger interconnectors that we were promised 10 years ago. And I think we've got to adopt a trading system which is dead simple and fair and reasonable, even if it offends the academic economists. Scandinavia has a system of pricing, and so they have 3 rules. Rule number 1 is we keep it simple. Rule number 2 is we keep it simple. And rule number 3 is we keep it simple. And I think that's what we've got to do. You've actually got to make it easy for people to use your transmission system. And then in the regulatory arrangements, I think we need a single, strong, national energy regulator to regulate the wholesale end of the business, not just about the states having organisations like Lou Owens to look after the retail end, but they've got to be coordinated with what I think needs to be a single, strong, national energy regulatory arrangements. Now, what do we do about the warring tribes? They still exist. I think one of the consequences is we're all going to have to get used to the fact that we need much greater federal government involvement in electricity supply. It's the only time in the past that anything has happened. I'm not greatly sympathetic to central solutions, but I think it's absolutely necessary. So I've been encouraging both political parties to say this is a matter of national importance, you've got to get involved. And I'm pleased to say there's a little bit of movement, a little bit with the current government, and I think more movement with the alternative government as well, and I'll be speaking to them next week. My solutions represent quite a change from the blind reliance on the market and short-term decisions that currently dominate what happens. But I think now, when we have to go back and redo it again, we can learn from the positive experiences that have applied overseas, where there are several competitive markets in the east of the United States, in Scandinavia, and now in the UK that work perfectly well. How do we get there? Before I went overseas, I was thumping the tub with the fact that we need not a reference to a productivity commission, but an independent expert review. And I come back on Friday to find that the state's ganged up on the Commonwealth, and that's what we've got. We're going to have a 3-man independent expert review. I have to be pleased with that. I hope they choose the right people and that they look at it dispassionately, and we might have taken a step on the right way. Now, there are a few things that I'd like to see South Australia do, and which I think you can infer from what I've said. South Australia badly needs to reconsider its dependence on one interconnection, one gas pipeline, needs to get competition in. The South Australian prices are the highest in the market. I think South Australia's got to take the lead in saying there needs to be temporary curbs on the bidding power of generators. I'd be hard enough to even use the licences that the government issues to the generators to bring them into line if necessary. They've got to get some retail competition going in the state. Some of the actions only are within South Australia's purview, and some require coordinated action with the other states, but the time to start is just now. Now, let me finish by saying it would really be very nice to have the luxury of starting to solve these many problems from another starting point, with a more rational and sensible national electricity market and a more rational competitive generation and retail structure in the start. But it's not an option anymore. We can't unscramble the egg. And that means to me that the way out's going to be a bit difficult and it's going to take some years to achieve. Now, I hope that the behaviour of the market is such that we're going to have the luxury of sitting down and debating it, that this three-man committee can take 12 months to analyse it and do something about it, and to devise a series of fixes that will prevent an unacceptable outcome. But I must say that I fear that we may not have that luxury, and that we may have to step in and take some more urgent and more drastic action to redirect the electricity industry into a more satisfactory and controlled state, and yet still retain the benefits that I argue competition can bring. So let me just remember three things. We're going to have to reform the trading system, reform the transmission system, reform our regulatory system is my recipe for today. So thank you for your attention, and I hope that I've been able to throw a little bit of light on what has been an obscure subject for far too long. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Booth. And now questions from the media. Would you go to the central microphone, please, and first state the organisation you represent before you ask a question. Thank you.
Dr. Booth, Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. After spending so much on inquiries and consultants, I'm thrilled to hear such a positive report about where we're heading with electricity. I'm told the Electricity Supply Association predicts that even with all the investment that is now planned, within 10 years we're going to need $20 billion worth of new investment to cope with electricity demand within 10 years. That's a lot of zeros. Do you agree with that sort of prediction? And where's the money going to come from? Is it out of our pockets?
I don't think there's anything basically wrong with that sort of projection. In modern society, we're more dependent on electricity than we even were, and we're experiencing quite high growth rates in this state and Victoria, particularly for air conditioning. I can tell you that people will invest when power prices are sensible. They do not need ridiculously high power prices to encourage them to invest. Indeed, with power prices in South Australia, as I say, the proverbial drover's dog would be interested in putting power generation in South Australia if he knows he can get $70 a megawatt hour at a wholesale rate. I can tell you that once we get prices under control, providing they don't collapse to ridiculously low levels, there will be no problem in getting all the investment that we need. And I must say that if we can do it with a bit more style than we currently do it, it will be the right kind of investment, not the opportunistic investment of, as I say, shipping used gas turbines from New Zealand to satisfy emergency peak demands in summer.
But just going on again, if we're talking about $20 billion, that's coming from consumers' pockets, from small business, large business. That's where the money's going to come from at the end of the day.
Total electricity business in Australia has a turnover of between $12 and $13 billion. I'm afraid it's like, do you remember the defence senator in the United States who he said a billion here and a billion there and pretty soon you're talking real money? I mean, in the power industry, I'm afraid billion-dollar sums are the norm. So $20 billion is not a frightening amount of money in terms of investment in power infrastructure over 10 years. And as I say, I think my main point is that sensible prices will bring forward adequate investment. You do not need ridiculous prices to bring forward adequate investment.
Dr. Booth, Jeremy Boylan for the ABC. You talk about the loose rules in the market as it stands at the present time. If governments move to tighten those rules, is there a danger that that will scare away new investment and new generation, particularly in a state like South Australia where it's so there's such a pressing need?
Well, there's no doubt, Jeremy, that all the generators will scream. I mean, I mentioned before that this market was designed by generators for the benefit of generators, and of course they will scream. But they know in their heart of hearts they're on a good thing. In fact, I can embellish this with a story. Just before I went overseas a month ago, I chaired a major conference in Sydney. It marked the release of a study by the World Energy Council. And the man who conducted that study was someone who was involved in the industry in the UK. And this guy, he wasn't a great speaker, but he fed me with a series of one-liners that I will dine out on, I'm sure, for the next 5 years. And he just simply said, we designed this market for the benefit of generators. We expected to control the price in the UK for 10 years, but we got it wrong after 4 years and the regulator came in. This is a market designed by generators and for generators. And yes, they will scream and object, but in my view, they were told that Australia was going to have a competitive electricity market. They have no basis for objecting when we deliver just that, a properly competitive electricity market.
And just if I may, in light of those benefits to generators, should the South Australian government have retained some control of its power assets, such as generators, when it privatised and leased?
It's always difficult, Jeremy. I mean, it's like the story of the Australian in Ireland who asked how to get to Tipperary, and when the locals said to him, if I was going to go to Tipperary, I wouldn't start from here. I mean, I basically wouldn't start from the premise that we've got. I think we've done so many things that are wrong that it's hard now to just pick one of them and say I would have done it differently. Unfortunately, what's happening in the other states who have not sold or leased their assets is that the government has stepped in and in New South Wales and Queensland, they siphon off excess profits from the generators and subsidise the retailers, only available to New South Wales generators and New South Wales retailers, and yet those same governments stand up and have the hide to claim that they're in a national competitive market. I mean, I think that cure is probably even worse than the ailment. Again, I think, take my point, I think while there are temporary things that we're going to have to do which won't be very nice and people will object to, I think what we've really got to do is fix the major problems, which are the trading system, the transmission and the regulatory system. And once we set that path, then we can deal with the actions we've got to take to go from where we are now to there. But some people are going to object, and indeed it's mainly going to be the generators because they're the principal beneficiaries.
Kim Wheatley from the Tizer.
I know the voice, Kim.
Just on that issue, what would you set the wholesale price cap at? What do you think would be fair?
Well, it's interesting. For those of you that are interested, in the back of the book, I actually do a calculation. In my view, the right price of electricity in Australia sits in the range from about the low 30s to the high $30 a megawatt hour. It's below 30 in Queensland because of their low coal cost. It's, I believe, in the low 30s in New South Wales and Victoria, and it's mid to high 30s here in South Australia with current prices. If the price in Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia was fluctuating between $30 and $40 a megawatt hour, I wouldn't be talking to you. I would be living in the south of France. But when it gets to 70, I've got to tell you that that's outrageous. In South Australia right now, if you can get gas, and that's a separate problem, providing that you can get a price of something in the high 30s, you will make a normal and an acceptable commercial return. And in my view, there is no justification for the price being any higher than that or a little more. So I guess, Kim, in terms of talking figures, when we persuaded the ACCC to set the cap at 40, probably a pretty good figure, a little bit on the conservative side, but anything higher than that, to me, is not acceptable.
What about over summer when the peaking plants are online?
Well, for those figures are annual averages. What you tend to have happen is higher prices in the summer when you're running the higher cost plants, lower prices in autumn and spring, and they come up again in winter. So you get this sort of, it looks like the humps on the back of a camel effect. But so I'm talking average prices. To me, price should vary with the real cost of production. What I'm against is when they vary because of gaming and playing around with the market rules. So it should be a bit higher in summer and in winter and lower in autumn and spring.
And you don't think that would have any impact on dampening investment?
Providing the average price over a year is sitting sort of, you know, in the mid to high 30s, no. The generators will talk their own book and say, oh, no, we need more than that. But I can tell you the experience shows in Queensland and elsewhere that that's all that you need. And maybe it's not the existing set of investors because they realise that they're onto a good thing. Maybe another set. But there's plenty of people around that would invest in power plants and will accept normal commercial returns. And I venture to say plenty of companies in South Australia that would be willing to underpin them with contracts if they offer reasonable prices.
Wendy Glemmerchak from ABC Radio News. What of the Premier's decision not to recommit to the entry date for residential consumers to the contestable market? Are there any legal ramifications or complications for the state?
Interesting question. I'm not sure that I can be so precise. I don't think that there are, unless the government was extraordinarily silly, I doubt if they, for example, sold ITSA Power with a hard and fast legal commitment that the market would be opened at the end of 2002. In fact, they could not have done that because they had to go to the ACCC to get ACCC authorisation for the protective arrangements. So I doubt if there are any legal ramifications. It comes as absolutely no surprise to me to see that the Premier's come back to say, I'm not going to let it happen. And as I say, had he not said it now, he most certainly will say it or find a reason for saying it at the end of next year. But because they would have had to have sold assets, making it clear that it was an ACCC decision and not the government's, I suspect that there are no direct legal ramifications.
Thank you.
And just a couple more, thank you.
Leonie Mellor, Channel 10. Just wondering, we're constantly told that everything will be okay come this summer as far as supply and prices go because of the extra capacity that's coming online. You seem to be saying that's not the case?
Absolutely, Leonie. We just got through last summer. I think the only thing that can save us is some of these investments coming in. Unless they're under construction now, it's going to be very difficult to have them running by summer. And it came as no surprise to me when DirectLink was dropped back until April. And even some of these other ones that are using second-hand machines, they'll be struggling to actually be running by summer. If the summer is as hot as last summer, we will be in trouble. The only thing that might save us is economic downturn and people not spending as much on air conditioners and the price rise dampening in the demand from industrial and commerce. But I don't think I'd be comfortable in running through another summer like last summer, and yet the balance between supply and demand next year is about the same as I see it at the present time, no better. What worries me as much about as the reliability of supply is the opportunity that it gives the generators to extract these high prices. And I think they're going to be just as damaging in the summer as physical loss of supply.
And just one other question. AGL often say that they are constantly seen as the bad guys in this and rather unfairly so, that what they're putting on the contracts they're offering to business, et cetera, is only a small margin, that their hand's always being forced by the generators. How do you see it?
Well, I think they'll have to defend themselves. There's no doubt the only that they can't get away with the wholesale price. AGL has no customer has any effect on the wholesale price. It's set entirely by the generators. This is why the regulator in the UK used to refer to this as being half a market. It's not a real market, it's only half a market. It's only the generators that participate in it. So AGL are the victims of these high wholesale prices like everybody else. All the add-on costs they have to justify. I must say, from my point of view, I'd be rather more comfortable if there were five or six retailers competing for customer demand in South Australia and they're all offering the same price. It's just a bit uncomfortable when there's only one. And I think AGL has to stand up and justify the fact that their prices are, if you like, a correct reflection of the wholesale price. But it is true they can't do anything about the wholesale price.
Robert, thank you. I think it was Rex Jury of the Advertiser who suggested that we should invite you to speak, and I think that was a very well-justified thing. Is that right, Don? Rex Jury suggested your name?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And I thank you very much for coming along. The quote you mentioned, I think, about the $1 million or the $1 billion was from a senator in the US Senate Finance Committee. I can't remember his name now, but he said, $1 billion here, $1 billion there, it soon adds up to real money. I've got two questions for you. One's hard and one's easy. The first one is, how does electricity travel down wires? That's the hard one. I want you to explain that to me. The second one is, if we come up for a hot summer in Adelaide this coming summer, as we had last summer, as you know, it's very hot, we've got many more electrical gadgets, including air conditioners, are we going to have a big problem? Open slather for that.
I must say, Robert, that even I, who have been in the industry all of my life, never cease to wonder when you connect up those three wires, providing you do them in the right order, and switch on a new generating plant and fire it up, and the electricity actually flows. I mean, it is a complicated process, but on the other hand, it's pretty easy. I mean, all that you're really doing is putting the energy into a rotating machine, and it's trying to go faster. And by the process of going faster, it actually forces the power to go down the lines. But apart from that, I'd need at least another hour to explain it to you. But all that I can say is that, to me, and I guess even to Kim and some of his people, there is still somewhat of a sense of wonder as to how it actually happens. And particularly when you build a transmission line that may go 500 kilometres, and you turn on the generator at that end and wind it up, connect it at this end, and lo and behold, the meter goes up and power is flowing down those three mysterious conductors in the air. But, I mean, I can assure you it happens. It's been happening for 100 years. I'm sure it'll happen for the next 100 years. And there are people around who know how to make it happen. Next summer, I think, is a problem, as I said to Leonie. I wish I could bring more news, but I don't. I think there's been a flood of investment. But overall, the balance between supply and demand this coming summer is really no better than it was last summer. And if you look at what happened last summer, we really just got through it by the skin of our teeth. So I hope that things are a little easier this summer, but I greatly fear it won't be any better.
Thank you very much indeed, ladies and gentlemen. Robert, you said you wanted... You said the wine was introduced before the speaker. Well, we're going to make amends for that. We'll give you a longer introduction. Thanks very much indeed, Dr. Robert Booth.
What an interesting address. Before you start talking, let's draw the raffle and you can chat afterwards. I'd like to call up Chris Willis, the news director of Channel 7. Chris, come and draw the raffle for us. Give him a hand. This is the man who's responsible for the Channel 7 news every night. Okay, I'll check it. Now you hold the whole thing. Away we go. Right, for the Telstra Panasonic cordless telephone, who has got them? I've mixed them all up. Give them a shake. Yes. Come over here.
Always wanted to be Sue's barrel boy. Number 79. 79L, what colour is that?
Blue
L79.
Yeah. Who's got it?
Kim Wheatley?
It's an aqua blue.
Aqua blue, very pretty. L79, no claimant. There oh, yes.
Here we go, for the phone. Okay. Chris, we've got two tickets to the hit musical Shout at the Festival Theatre, starring David Campbell.
What's that name there? Purple F24.
Is it Cam?
I can't read the writing, sorry. Thanks.
Purple F, let's have a look. Yes, let's see.
Terrific. Yes, fantastic. Right, we've got a dozen bottles of Jacob's Creek wines from Orlando Wyndham.
It's a bad draw because it's purple F14. So from the same table.
King, yes.
So is that K?
Take them afterwards, K. Now, Robert Main has given us his Bimbimbi. That's hard to say, that. Bimbimbi 1999 McLaren Vale Shiraz, two bottles.
Okay, L, blue, 77, C, chalk.
Chris Chalk. Where is he? There he is. Hey.
What's that?
It's the two bottles of Robert... Two bottles from Robert May. Well, we've got the CD of Shout, The Legend of the Wild One.
Okay, J. Charmaine Applin.
Oh, Charmaine. Come on, you Charmaine. Carton of Hahn Premium Beer from SA Brewing. We'll pick the Hahn Premium Light first.
Purple F, 47, Craig Clark, Sunday Mail.
Sunday Mail. Okay, pick it up afterwards. Let's see your ticket.
We better check the Sunday Mail's ticket. Make sure it's... Okay.
And the other carton of Han Premium?
Oh, God, another Sunday Mail person. Rachel Hancock.
Okay, now we've got three double VIP passes, so for three different draws here, a double for each one to the Royal Adelaide Show. Thanks, Francine, for these. August 31st to September 8th is the show, 78 days to go.
J89, colour?
Turquoise blue.
Turquoise blue, J89.
2, 3,
there's one for
one.
Oh, show
me. Oh,
no. Good girl. Okay.
Does Charmaine get all it?
No, just one. And the same draw again for two tickets?
Some orange ones.
Oh, well, let's have a look at it. Here we go. No, I'm gonna disqualify myself from that one.
He's drawn his own, he's disqualifying himself. You're a good boy.
Okay, J37. J37? Come on, quickly, otherwise we're going to draw another one.
Up the back.
J37.
Pamela.
Yes.
Pamela Schultz.
Pamela Schultz.
Last one.
Last one. Here we go for this particular...
Orange F17.
Orange F17.
Let's have a look at yours, Pamela.
Yes. Now stay there. No, stay there. This is not in fact, the last one, but stay there, Chris. What I'd like to say is that, one of our most loyal supporters of the Press Club is Walter Rogers. Now, before we draw his restaurant vouchers that he gives us at every Press Club lunch, I'd like to announce that the Press Club has its first match made in heaven. Because it was an October lunch when Walter clapped eyes on Ewa Lado from the Craniofacial Foundation, and they didn't hear a word of that lunch. They can't even remember who the guest speaker was, but I can tell them that it was Peter Meakin of A Current Affair. And Walter and Ewa have asked me to formally announce their engagement and their forthcoming marriage in November. Would you come on up here, guys? And President Don, where are you? Here he comes. Bring them up on the stage here. Congratulations to you both. And Walter, come on up here. You come up here. Lovely. There we go.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's lovely. A match made in heaven. Terrific. Now, you've got your vouchers for today. We're going to draw them. Chris, would you draw them?
Right.
Rigoni's first. We'll do Rigoni's first. $50 voucher.
Okay, for the first one, it is Peter Haynes.
Wow.
Great.
Congratulations, Peter. And Walter also has one for the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gooja Street.
And the winner is J47. J47.
Wow, there we go. That's it. Thank you. Congratulations. Thank you. Please thank Chris Willis from Channel 7, News Director. And congratulations to Walter and Ewa. That's wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, we hope you've enjoyed today. See you at the next Press Club luncheon. And if you want to be on the mailing list, let us know at the front desk. Thank you very much and good afternoon.
Sorry, I've just got one more thing to say. I haven't told you about some of our upcoming speakers. I'm not quite sure who we've got next month. We're negotiating with someone wonderful. But after that, we have that well-known lover of the press, Stuart Littlemore. And then in October, to talk about Federation, we've got Professor Geoffrey Blaney, which is one I don't want to miss at all. Thank you.